Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From a secret location not far from Nice Guy Productions World Headquarters, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. In fact, this will be the final one-on-one postmortem interview before we close the show with our live spectacular we are recording at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood next week. It's been an amazing 7-year run of conversations that will stick with me for the rest of my life. The generosity and creativity of all of our guests has been expansive and remarkable. Our final guest is one of the most influential filmmakers ever to hit Hollywood, a Southern Californian who has created a resume of movies so distinctive that they become a subgenre of their own, and so influential that many imitators strive to be called Tarantino-esque. Quentin Tarantino has always done it his way. His movies, filled with revelatory performances from actors familiar and otherwise, dialogue that seems shot from a Gatling gun, and a pace that never lets you go, are not just love letters to Hollywood, but are so personal and contemporary that they cannot be mistaken for another director's work. But there's so much more to Quentin than his work as a screenwriter and director. His books and his amazing podcast with Roger Avery, Video Archives, are filled with just as much excitement and creativity as his movies. I can't think of a better guest to sum up our collection of over 180 interviews than Quentin Tarantino. Quentin, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's so great to be here. I mean, I think your podcast has been the... You know, I think the benchmark for appreciating and interviewing genre directors.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, and then it's about time you had me on here.
Yeah, we've been trying. You're a busy man.
Yes, you have.
Busy man. But one of the great things about your work, you've kind of tidied up what your life's involvement with movies is in your book, Cinema Speculations. I love this book. Pauline Kael had I Lost It at the Movies, which was her personal introduction of how movies changed her life. Yours is so much more fervid and passionate and personal and uncensored. And I just love that about it. You're a Southern California native from the South Bay. And your dad wanted to be an actor. Your biological dad wanted to be an actor, but you never really knew him. You had a stepfather, Kurt.
Yeah, who was my father, as far as I was concerned.
Right, and he had a passion for movies, as did your mother.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I mean, one of the things, growing up with Kurt and my mom. Well, they were very young. My mom was at least 16 when she had me. She might have even been younger. We don't talk about that. But you know, they were, she was a nurse and he was a piano bar musician. So they didn't have that much money. So, you know, going out to the movies was like one of the things that they could do.
Right.
And they took me out with them. But one of the things about being with Kurt is because he was a piano bar musician before I started going to school, you know, which was around, I don't think I started like nursery school until around like four,
right,
or something like that. So before then, I'm just at home. Well, Kurt's taking care of me all day long because he's a piano bar musician. So he works at night, and then when my mom's at work at the hospital, he gets to take care of me during the day. And, you know, so we'd watch TV. And so some old movie would be on TV and say Thomas Mitchell is in the movie.
Right.
You know, so we're watching the movie, and then Thomas Mitchell's in there and goes, oh, Quentin, see, that's Thomas Mitchell. He was a good character actor. He's in a lot of movies, but he played the father in the original Swiss Family Robinson. You know the one we saw? Yeah, I remember the one. Yeah, I saw the Disney one. Yeah, well, they did another version of it in the 30s, and he was the father in that. Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting, huh? And I'm trying to imagine him starring in the John Mills one that I saw.
Right.
And then it would be something else. He'd be watching something like, oh, Roddy McDowell. I really, really like him, especially when he plays assholes. Or Lee Marvin. But like that Thomas Mitchell example, he would pick out some little example like that of film history about whatever it is I was watching.
So he had knowledge of
that's the punchline of the story, all right? Because the thing about it, you know, a bad guy shows up, a famous character actor playing back, oh, that's so-and-so. Oh, that's Jack Palance, you know, or that's Royal Dano, you know. He'd point out stuff like that. Okay, so, yes, he had knowledge. He didn't really have vastly amounts more knowledge than a lot of other adults did at that time. He just knew a bunch of actors.
Right, right.
He knew a bunch of actors. A lot of people knew who character actors were, especially back then.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they grew up with them. And, but now, I, as a little boy, think Kurt is a movie expert. I mean, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this is so wonderful. So this is what it's like to be an adult? You watch a movie and you know the name of every actor in it? You watch a movie, not only do you know the name of every actor in it, you know their whole filmography? You can describe their career?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I can't wait to be an adult where I could like know this. Well, I guess I better start right now. I better start like learning my shit, you know? So I know it when I get to be an adult. Well, okay, so then I start accumulating my knowledge as a child, and I get to a certain point, and then I realize, no, Kurt wasn't a movie expert. He was just like an adult who liked movies and knew the names of a bunch of actors, like a lot of people do.
Right, but you were a celluloid.
I now am a movie expert.
You're a celluloid sponge.
Yes.
You absorbed everything about the film world because you knew there was more to movies. You set out to be an actor.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even, what I just described, it was the first time I've described it that way. And I was just hearing myself describing it. I mean, the idea of watching a movie and not knowing the name of all the actors and not knowing their entire filmography, I don't even know what that would be like. All right, this is like, you know, when I watch a Bollywood movie or when I watch a movie from Pakistan or something like that. Okay, that's a movie. All right, I don't know anybody. I don't know what's going on.
But that's the thing about movies and you is it doesn't matter the genre.
Mm-hmm.
Your passion is all encompassing. The world of film is like celluloid in your veins.
Yeah, it is.
And
well, it's been for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. What is it about movies that gives you so much joy? The medium of film itself.
I don't know. I'm not 100% sure. All right. How to answer that question? That directed a question per se. All I know is, look, just as a little boy, because it all started when I was a kid, and it's just as a little kid, you're either drawn to this thing or you're drawn to that thing. Some kids are drawn to sports. A kid's drawn to football. Some kids are drawn to drawing.
Right.
Oh, a kid in the back. Some kids are drawn to cars. They read car magazines. If they're going to doodle, they draw cars. They make car models. All right. Other kids are into whatever they're into. All right. Movies were always my thing.
Right.
You know, movies were all, you know, there's that other kid that, like, it reads history all the time. It reads books all the time. He's always reading a book. I was always, there was something about movies. Movies always were it for me. And I think why, I don't know. All right. But the environment that I learned them in the late, late 60s, early 70s, when I'm like really introduced to them in a big way, I think had something to do with it, because you have a combination of New Hollywood cinema, which I think is arguably the greatest cinema ever produced in the history of Hollywood. Yeah. So I'm seeing that as it's happening right now. I watch a New Hollywood movie at 6 or 7 or 8. That's my idea of a movie. These are movies.
Right.
I'm learning what a movie is by watching Joe.
Right.
I'm learning what a movie is by watching Where's Papa?
Right. And this is...
Or in, Man Called Horse or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is in the wake of Easy Rider,
yes,
where all of the studio executives realized they didn't know what the fuck they were doing. They
absolutely
put it in the hands of exciting, young, experimental directors.
But on the other side of that, you also had a very vibrant local television experience with all the local TV stations playing all their movies. The Channel 9 Million Dollar Movie.
Every night of the week.
Yeah, KTTV's Movie Greats, where they had all the MGM ones, all the classic movies. I learned who most of the big classic stars were, you know, like from watching Movie Greats. You know, and all the, you know, and all the Marx Brothers movies and the Laurel and Hardy movies and the Abbott Costello movies, that I watched them all.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so the combination of like learning about this classic cinema so richly delivered, all right, by the local stations in Los Angeles, and then the New Hollywood movies at the theaters that my parents were taking me to see, that was, you know, that's a pretty good cocktail for falling in love with movies.
Yeah, and it's a kind of parenting that isn't common, where they would bring you along to the R-rated or unrated movies and all that, and it had to have formed something in you that is with you today. And as a parent yourself, do you have that desire to teach your children as they're growing up about the kind of history and film that you were exposed to?
Oh, well, of course. That's almost the reason to have a kid.
Do you think
it's like I could teach them some of this shit that's running around in my brain? You know, it's something to do with it. I mean, as it is, like right now, like for instance, like okay, my son Leo is only like is only 3 and a half. So he's still a little too young to sit down and watch a movie.
Right.
From beginning to end.
Right.
But he can watch like a full half hour cartoon now. And be into it from beginning to end. And so of course he has the shows. He has the stuff on YouTube and this and the modern baby cartoon. He's getting more better than baby cartoon stuff. But but the toddler cartoon stuff that he likes. So there's all that stuff that he likes, and there's all the YouTube channels of kids playing with toys that he likes.
Right, right.
But I'm also showing him the Max Fletcher Superman cartoons,
nice,
and he loves them. And
the 3D Popeye cartoons
with
multi-level.
Well, I haven't shown him that yet, I've shown him like the 70s Super Friends, and I've shown him like the Filmation Batman cartoons and the Superman cartoons, and I showed him like the I've shown him the 60s Spider-Man cartoons, and he knows the song, he can sing the theme song.
That's fantastic.
All right, I showed him the other day the 80s Rambo cartoon.
Oh wow!
All right, and he didn't seem like he liked it that much, but then he started referring to play, he was saying he was playing Rambo, he was playing his figures, he said, "No, I'm Rambo," but he doesn't know his name is Rambo, he thinks his name is Rainbow.
He'll learn soon enough.
Yeah, but even like with the figures I give up like, you know, a vintage a Planet of the Apes figures.
Yeah,
I give him a vintage Godzilla and Rodan. He knows the name of Rodan. He knows the name of Gamera. Yeah. He knows him.
Godzilla minus one is pretty amazing.
Yeah,
have you seen the new one?
No, I've heard about it. I've heard it's great.
It's amazing.
I'm gonna probably see it in the next like couple days. Actually,
it's fantastic, and I think you'll really like it. But when did renegade cinema start to appear? Appeal to you, the out of the mainstream stuff, because
good question.
Your book focuses so much on how independent film that didn't originate in Hollywood became such a big part of your passion.
Well, you know, it's interesting because every once in a while they did, but for the most, but for the most part, if my parents were taking me to see an exploitation movie, it was usually only like the second film on the bill.
Right, right.
Or they picked an exploitation movie by accident. They didn't realize it was quite as cheap as it was. But like, for instance, I remember one night in 1970 where we're figuring out what we're going to go see. We almost went and saw The Losers.
Oh, wow.
How awesome would that have been to see The Losers with your parents when it opened, all right, at a movie
when you're
theater.
9 years old.
And they just decided at the last minute to go to something else. Oh. That would have just been amazing. But when I started being able to go, once I got to be old enough, which was not that old, I mean, like 10 or 11, all right, maybe 11, we'll say 11. I think it was like around 11 when my mom started just dropping me off at the theater.
So the theater became your babysitter.
Yeah, it's like, and that wasn't like she wanted to get rid of me. No, that was my weekend. That's what I wanted to do.
Right,
you know? And so she just dropped me off at the theater. And so what I could kind of start doing going on my own now, I'm seeing whatever like looks good on the TV spots that they're showing that week on TV or what looks good in the newspaper. And so that's when I started discovering B movies and I started realizing, these are cheaper than the Hollywood movies and they look it and they don't quite have the prestige of the Hollywood movies. And no, Paul Newman's not going to be in this and Elizabeth Taylor is not going to be in this, but some of these people who are here are pretty cool. But And often, a lot of times they're not good.
Right.
But they might have a scene. They might have a moment. They might have a tone that is contraband that you're just not going to find in a Hollywood movie.
Right.
And maybe they're going to go, they'll go too far as the violence is concerned, or too far as the sex is concerned, or too far as the sensation is concerned. Well, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go too far. Yeah. That's what I wanted to see. All right. I mean, it really is pretty much the equivalent of somebody listening to the Ramones.
Right.
When they first came out, as opposed to Hall & Oates.
Yes. They have their value.
They both have their value. Okay, they both have their place, and they're both defined by their opposites of each other as far as the production values are concerned and the pleasures they offer.
Right.
And the Ramones is very specific.
It's very visceral.
For what it is, but it is very visceral, and if you get it, you get it.
Right. Right. And the Ramones, seeing them in concert was one of the great memories in rock and roll high school and all that. Just great stuff. But it also feels like this renegade cinema is embracing something that you wouldn't want your parents to embrace.
Yeah. In what way? Explain that.
To break away, to be, I'm my own person. Mm-hmm. I love this thing. My mom's going to hate this music because it's loud and abrasive, and that's a really good reason to take it on.
Well, it's interesting, okay, because it wasn't like I was liking these movies and they had a problem with me liking these movies or anything like that. It was, except unless it was like a big hit, like a Halloween or something like that. It was almost more the, better way of saying it is it's something that I was experiencing through childhood and preteens and teenage years and even into my early 20s completely all by myself.
Right.
I had nobody to share this with. It wasn't like I had a B-movie buddy.
Right.
It wasn't like I had a B-movie kid that lived down the street who liked blaxploitation movies too. I might trick a kid into going with me. All right, and take him to a really sketchy part of town that they weren't used to going to.
Right.
All right. But it's like, you know, so if I'm seeing The Girl from Starship Venus, or if I'm seeing a double feature of Axe and the Child, or if I'm seeing a Crater Lake Monster and Land of the Minotaur together, there's nobody for me to talk to about. I watched it on my own.
Yeah.
I watched it on my own. It was an experience. I didn't know anybody in this fucking theater. All right. It was an experience I had completely to myself. I never shared it with anybody. There was, well, what am I going to talk about the Crater Lake Monster to anybody about unless I saw you that day?
Right. Right. I was the same way. I was the kid who was into the genre movies that nobody else.
Yeah.
I didn't know anybody like that in school or anything. But you'd seek them out. But I had a more protective childhood than you did. But there's about a decade that separates us in age. But the 70s, you've said many times that it's, to you, the most important and best decade of movie making. What defines that? Was it the newfound freedom, the feeling that there are no controls put on, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre? You knew none of the people on the screen, none of the filmmakers. Yeah. You didn't know what they were going to put in your face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, that's very true. But I do think, though, at the same time, it's not the independent movies that make New Hollywood. I think it's the independent movies that helped New Hollywood become New Hollywood.
Ah.
I mean, I think it was... In a way, something like the Wild Angels, but especially the Wild Angels.
Yeah.
Something like the Wild Angels, and then the other AIP, Richard Rush, Jack Starrett, biker films, or even the fanfare movies that came out in the wake of that. They existed in a more visceral world that was connected to the zeitgeist of the times in a way that the Hollywood movies of 66 and 67 and 68 weren't.
Right.
All right. There was a real, there was a progressiveness even to something like Three in the Attic or Wild in the Streets that went further than a Hollywood movie would go. If Warner Brothers were doing the script of Wild in the Streets, it wouldn't end with Shelley Winters being put in a concentration camp.
Right.
All right, we're all the 30, that wouldn't be where it all ended.
And then in the 70s...
Yeah, it could have a weird ironic ending, but nothing that terrible.
Right, right. But you know, it seemed like as the 70s progressed, the studios wanted to go deeper into the independent world because that's where the young audience was that they could get.
Well, you know, there's even you can even make a case, even comparing something, you know, we're like, okay, even comparing something like Three in the Attic to Bob and Carol, Ted and Alice. Now, Bob and Carol, Ted and Alice is a better movie.
Right.
In every way, shape and form, frankly. But I like Three in the Attic.
Yeah.
But Three in the Attic goes forward with its menage a trois of the women fucking Paxton Quigley until they can kill him in a way that Bob and Carol, Ted and Alice stop short of the couple swapping.
Right.
It stops short of its own subject.
Right. But
Three in the Attic doesn't.
It becomes timid on the studio.
Yeah,
level.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Three in the Attic doesn't. I mean, you know, Mazursky does it in an artistic way, so it doesn't seem like a cop out. But nevertheless, it doesn't go through with its, you know, its point of being.
But directors began to be able to express themselves.
My point, though, was those zeitgeist movies helped nudge Hollywood.
Right.
Take Hollywood out of its fun for the entire family. 60s,
the
Hal
Jack Warner
B. Wallace,
yeah.
Ross Hunter,
yeah.
Hollywood world into the new Hollywood. It was AIP helped kind of almost like a tugboat.
Yeah, yeah. And then in 74, you get The Exorcist from Warner Brothers that you never would have seen in 64.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, absolutely. Well, to me, that's what really makes new Hollywood is the idea that... it's just the way it was for the beginning of Hollywood, from the very, very beginning of Hollywood, that if you do a famous book or a famous play that has controversial, mature themes or adult situations or adult subjects or sex or whatever, or anything super unconventional, that if done in Hollywood, those elements would be taken out of it. Right. Or they would be lessened, or they would be changed, and you know that everything that was like that would go through a deflavortizing
right.
aspect. All right, when nothing could be presented with integrity, it always had to be dealt with in a certain way. Well, by the 70s, for the most part, pretty much anything you could write could be done and done with integrity. Now it's up to you to pull it off and it's up to you to do it right. But that was the case. Now, to me, that's what really, to me, that's what the all freedom was about. It wasn't the freedom to say fuck.
Right.
All right. It was the freedom that material could be done in an uncompromised way, unlike any other time in the history of Hollywood before. And except for some people, and in some cases, since.
Right. Do you think in 1968, when the Motion Picture Association came out with the ratings, GMRX mm-hmm. ratings, do you think that helped liberate filmmaking?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. It absolutely did. There was now there was no excuse.
Right.
Why they, why they couldn't do it. Look, the audience and the times were demanding it. All right. And then, the ratings, I've never had a problem with the ratings board, but other filmmakers have run afoul of the ratings board. And there has definitely been times where there's been more hypocrisy in the way they've handed out their ratings as opposed to other times. I lived in a really great time. Yeah. Joan Graves, me and her got along like a house on fire. I was lucky. I could have grown up in the time of Richard Hefner. Instead, I came of the time of Joan Graves, and it worked out fantastic. We had a lovely relationship. I really regretted when she stepped down as the head. But what the ratings board did that was so fantastic is it stopped any jerk. It stopped the sheriff of any jerkwater county.
Right.
From suing your movie for their local obscenity laws.
Great point.
And once that was taken off the table, then there was no really reason to hide anymore.
Right. And an X rating would go to straightforward movies. Now it's synonymous with pornography. But at that time, it just meant over 17.
Yeah, exactly.
And Midnight Cowboy.
And this is adult.
Right.
An adult movie. This is an adult movie. Yeah.
Yeah. And all of that.
Adult meant adult. It didn't mean sex. All right. It could mean sexual themes.
Right. Like Midnight Cowboy was rated X.
Midnight Cowboy is a sexual theme. Yeah.
Right. Right. Do you think television also had an effect in that movies were competing for people passively staying home in front of a TV screen and going out to the movies? You know, you'll get something that you can't get on television.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's for sure. And I mean, it was always kind of an interesting thing in the 70s as far as you had a lot of re-releases. So movies played in theaters for a long time. One, they played in theaters a long time.
Right.
That's that. All right. Yeah. I mean, a movie could play for 6 months. To one degree or another.
Right.
You know, and something like My Fair Lady like kind of just plays continuously for like
yes.
a year and a half.
Yeah.
If not
yeah.
2 years, you know. Yeah. But the big hits, the ones that did well, they come out, they do well, and then usually 2 or 3 years later, there's a whole re-release of them.
Right.
And they get a whole brand new release.
Right. It wasn't just Disney doing that.
Everybody. No, it was a whole brand new release. And like in the case, like for instance, in the case of the, I believe it was the 75 re-release of The Sting.
Oh, yeah.
The Sting made almost as much money in the 75 re-release as it did in the 73 original release.
Amazing. Yeah.
And for instance, if they don't count this, but if they did count it, if they counted it, the 1972 re-release of Gone with the Wind
right.
would be in the top 10 highest grossing movies of the 70s if they counted it.
Wow.
But the thing is, though, okay, that's Gone with the Wind. I'm talking about, American Graffiti or right. The, I saw the, I missed a lot of the stuff in 73 because I was in Tennessee. So I caught up with it during the re-releases in 74 and 75. I saw the re-release of Blazing Saddles.
Right.
All right. In 74 or 75. I saw the re-release of American Graffiti. I saw the re-release of the Exorcist. Okay. So now those are the big ones. But then in the world of double features, okay, a movie like Burt Reynolds' Fuzz, movie like George C. Scott's The Last Run, movie like Jack Lemmon's The War Between Men and Women, that would be, it did what it did when it came out, kind of came and went, but then it becomes a secondary feature. And it's a good secondary feature. And now, that's around for like 3 years.
Right. It's not a B movie. It's an A movie that is now.
Yeah. Well, it's double MGM has stats. MGM wants MGM has the A title. They want the B title. That way they get the whole box office.
Right. Right.
MGM gives them an entire program. You know, and so those were easy ones. The Grissom Gang. That was the easy ones that popped up on the second features for years.
Right. Right.
My point about all that was, if it was a 70s movie. Like, say, The French Connection.
Right.
And by the way, talk about re-releases, okay? They release French Connection, then there's a re-release of the French Connection, then there's a double feature re-release of the French Connection and Vanishing Point.
Yeah. All right?
Then there's another re-release, the French Connection and the Seven Ups. And then there's another re-release, the French Connection and Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. All right? They're all Fox movies, all Fox car chase movies.
Right.
But the thing is, by the time that the French Connection shows up on the ABC Sunday Night Movie, it's cut up so much, and this is before video, so you feel like, okay, it's lost.
Yeah.
Okay, now the movie's gone. Yeah. So they hung around a lot longer, but when they went to TV, it was as if they were gone for good.
Yeah.
You'll never be able to see, because it's before video, you'll never be able to see the French Connection the way it was when it came out.
Yeah. No, it was like 1977 when I got my first Betamax, and working at Tower Records in Westwood. And it was like, it opened. Well,
actually, you would have got French Connection because Magnetic Home Video was the first company out, and then they made a deal with Fox.
All the
Fox shit was the first shit that ever came out.
Yeah, and it just, it opened doors. That and Nostalgia Merchant with the Val Wooten
movies and things like that
came out.
Well, this classic session is just filled with Nostalgia Merchants.
Yeah, I was going to say, this, your whole podcast, which we'll get to in a bit, is all about those movies and watching them on VHS.
Yeah, there's the Laurel and Hardy. There's the Nostalgia Merchant Laurel and Hardy section right there.
But it's so beautiful that you can hold a movie in your hands and watch it whenever you want.
My gosh, I felt that way when I was like, when I was four, I felt that way about having a Viewmaster of the Mod Squad.
Yes.
I felt like to me, that was like having a print of the Mod Squad.
Right. Or I remember recording on a little audio tape recorder, reel-to-reel, a movie on television. So I'd listen.
I did that too. No, I did that too. I knew a guy, a video, a customer of Video Archives. He recorded It's a Wonderful Life. All right, off of television. And they would drive around in his car and just listen to The Wonderful Life. And then when he gets to the end with Zuzu's Pedals, he's driving, he's crying, all right, listening to the last 10 minutes.
What movie has made you cry?
Oh, I'm easy to cry in movies.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm a sucker. I'm really easy.
Yeah. And what about making somebody cry from one of your movies?
Well, that's all just individual, you know. People told me it's happened before. Some female friends of mine actually said that they got very weepy at the end of Kill Bill, all right, with BB and the bride. Yeah.
Well, for me, my favorite of your films and the one that feels most personal to me is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I agree. Grew up in LA. I feel the same way, and I feel that way for the exact same reason.
Yeah, I grew up in L.A. I was there in the 70s and was it's so accurate and so potent and so human. And, you know, got to know Brad a little bit when I was producing Unbroken, when he and Angie were together.
Oh, uh-huh.
And just his performance is so great, and the whole Rick Dalton character and everything. It is so thought, and your knowledge of period television, the Westerns of the time are so perfectly recreated. And tell me about how you went about that, because it's obviously really personal and obviously reflects a Southern California sensibility.
Well, you know, it's funny. There is a little bit like where you, as I started getting into my 50s, I started like, you know, wondering a little bit of like, almost like everything I told you before about that story about, oh, I got to fill my head full of shit so I know about all the, know about the movies like I'm supposed to. Somewhere in my 50s, with the way the world's become, with everybody hits things and it's all right there, and everybody has access to IMDb and Google this and looking up this and that and the other, that, you know, what is personal knowledge, what does personal knowledge mean anymore? And you know, so obviously I'm not serious about this, but I'm like, okay, was I idiotic for spending all this, my life, filling my head full of this stuff? Okay, obviously the answer is no. All right. You know, but it did make it seem a little bit more of like ever so slightly wasted effort. That all this shit is just so easy and almost how people don't care about it anymore. So as I'm putting myself in the world of Rick Dalton, and creating the world of Rick Dalton and the world that Rick Dalton lives in and the people that Rick Dalton knows. And I know these type of actors, you know, I mean, there's the actors I personally know and all the other ones I don't know that I know of. And yeah, I am extremely well-versed about that time period, especially when it comes to the actors and especially when it comes to those, you know, when it comes to like the young career of a Charles Bronson or a James Coburn, you know, going from Laramie, you know, to Bonanza, to Wagon Train, to, oh, okay, now you got like 9 days on this movie, and then you're back again. I'm really into that, you know. I was just watching a James Coburn Bonanza before you got here. So there was this, and I know it. I truly know it. I mean, I know it like if I had grown up a fisherman and now I'm going to write a movie about tuna fishing.
Yeah.
Well, my dad's a fisherman and I grew up on a fishing boat. Right. So that's, I know what I'm talking about.
Right.
Well, I have that level of knowledge.
Yeah.
When it comes to this subject. And I'm like, I might be the only guy my age that actually knows this much.
Yeah. I should know that much. Yeah, right?
This much about this time that's past my time.
Right.
And literally all the other people that I will be talking to who are from this time are like 80.
Yes.
Or 78 or something like that.
Yeah.
And so there was this weird aspect that was like, holy shit. Have I spent my whole life putting this stuff into my head just to get me ready to write this script?
Which is reason enough.
Well, it would be reason enough. It would be reason enough. It was like, wow. I just have been doing research on this just because it's what I care about and it's what I'm into and I like being an expert on it. But it's all, but when I ask, was there a reason for this? Here's the answer.
Yeah. And it's a great answer.
Oh, thank you.
And it's also so obvious that it's personal to you, not only because the film just is filled with passion and emotion and these performances and the storytelling, but also you wrote a novelization that goes beyond the end of the movie. The novel is not a novelization because it's more than that. And that is so beautifully written and elegiac in a lot of ways. But also the Rick Dalton tribute, the last two episodes of the first season of the Video Archives podcast.
Sorry, kind of our first radio play.
It's amazing, and it is so thought out. I mean, how much time did you spend putting together all these cast lists and movies that you made up and TV series that all fit into the right networks and everything for the period. The verisimilitude of this is phenomenal.
Well, the thing was, is what I ended up doing during the pandemic, just for fun. I mean, you know, I spent half my time in Los Angeles and half my time with my family in Israel.
Yeah.
And when I'm in Israel, when I'm not playing with the kids, I've got to have something to do. All right, you know? I come up with I do my work writing here. I do kind of my fun hobby writing there.
Oh, interesting.
And so, because I have enough knowledge, I have enough information, I could do this. I thought, I mean, it's ridiculous how much I'm into Rick Dalton and into his career. I mean, I'm kind of obsessed with it. All right. And I was like, you know what? I want to find out exactly what happened to him.
Yeah.
After the movie. I mean, I want to know exactly, not thereabouts.
Right.
I want to know exactly. And I don't want to have to come up with a story.
And you weren't done with him.
Yeah. I just wasn't done with him.
Yeah.
I wanted to know what happened with him, but I didn't want to have to come up with some cockamamie narrative that I had to stick. I didn't want to have to come up with a story. All right. And so I was like, well, so what I did is I sat down in Israel and I wrote a book called The Films of Rick Dalton.
Oh my God. Is that where the interviews came from?
Yes. Okay. So, I mean, I'm embarrassed to tell you how strenuously researched this was.
Well, it
or just
shows.
Something for myself. I worked so hard researching this because the whole thing was, so I do his whole career that we already know about, you know, all the films we know about. But I mean, every single episodic television episode he did.
Right.
All right. And I didn't just yank shit out of my ass. Okay. So if he's going to be in a Tombstone territory, I watch like five Tombstone territories until I find one that, Rick could have been in that.
Oh, this is fantastic.
Rick could have been in that one. So I just, the director's name and, you know, it's all listed. I describe a little bit of the storyline. Maybe Rick talks about it a little bit.
Right.
What it was like. And that, you know, then there's a few episodes, like I make up an entire episode, you know, like for M Squad. All right. The whole story with Betty Davis and everything. So I make that up. But I went through his whole career and then, so then the incident happened and we go on from where the movie happened and the same thing. I went through all the movies he did and I went through the episodes he guested on. And once it got into a certain time period, especially like around the 70s, then Rick is kind of an amalgamation of about four different actors of that time period, mm-hmm. but like eight or nine different actors of that time period.
Like Will Hutchins and people.
Yeah,
of that
could
sort.
Fit. I wouldn't go so far him, but more like Gary Lockwood.
Right, gotcha.
All right, you know. So if Gary Lockwood did an episode of $6 Million Man, well, that's something that Rick could have done too.
Right.
All right. If Ty Harden did an episode of David Cassidy Undercover, well, that's something that Rick could have done. All right. Yeah. Those are good. If Monty Markham did an episode of this show, that's another thing that Rick could have done on Dan August or something. You know. So that's something that could have happened. And so the point being is, I just did all this work, and I was very happy with it, but it was like. And I even talked to the publishing company about publishing it.
Yeah.
But then the first book came out. I go, okay, well, these books are actually doing pretty good. I don't think I can come out with this bullshit. What the fuck is this, like, insane lunacy?
I want to read that book.
Yeah. No, you would like it. Yeah. And Tom McCarthy would like it. And people like that would like it. Everyone else would be, what the fuck is this shit? All right. So when it came time to do the last episode, and I got the Rick, I go, hey, here's something. I have all the information.
Yeah.
All right. So I don't need to tell everybody that I have the information. I just have the information.
Right.
So I can talk about it with this base of knowledge.
And you have Gala and Roger in on it. And
they did an amazing job. You know, we watched all the stuff that we were supposed to watch. You know, it was improvisational theater based on a ton of research,
right,
that we all did, so we could talk freely about it.
Well, it's so great, and the trajectory of his career and its ups and mostly downs that happen, yeah, as well are so genuine, and yeah, you feel them, and you hurt for him, yeah, and you celebrate with him.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Oh, but it all ends pretty good. You know, he does The Fireman.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, which becomes his big hit.
He becomes a straight. He becomes a straight to video action star. Yeah.
He's Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah. He comes. Yeah. He's doing tons of Antonio Margheriti and Sarah, yeah, Santiago movies.
Love that. You know, the Hollywood star who's not doing so great anymore goes to Italy. It becomes.
Well,
a
he
big
ends up doing
star,
pretty good, because, yeah, by the 80s, because of his action, his video action movie status, you know, he becomes the top rate, all right, for a,
right,
guest star,
right,
in the 80s, all right, you know, because he's actually like a movie star now again, you,
yeah,
know? And he's an action star. So, you know, it's described, I can't remember if it's on the episode or not, but it's described that, you know, he talks about it, and he goes, so when it comes to that top rate for a star guesting on an episodic television, he goes, well, Rick Dalton would say, well, in the 60s, that was the Robert Culp rate. And that was the Darren McGavin rate.
Mm-hmm.
No. In the 60s, that was the Robert Culp rate.
Right.
In the 70s, that was the Darren McGavin rate.
Yeah.
In the 80s, that was the David Carradine rate. Now it's the Rick Dalton rate.
Yes. But
yeah, so when he does a Fall Guy, you know, he's paid the highest. He's paid the highest that anyone gets paid. For, you know,
right,
when he does a Chips, he gets paid the highest.
It's so great.
Yeah, when he does a Masquerade.
Yeah. But the shows are the real shows, and the,
yeah,
cast,
yeah,
and he fits perfectly into these things.
If John Saxon fits in there, so does Rick. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you've created this character who represents that time period that spans decades,
yeah,
in such a complete way that it's one of the most complete film characters I know of, because he goes way beyond his presence in that movie.
I think you're, thank you for saying that, by the way. And this is a weird thing to say to somebody who just paid me a great compliment. I completely agree with you. My only caveat for such egotism is I think it's really, it only works for people like me and you. Everybody else. It's fucking Greek.
Yeah. But it's.
But for us, yes, you're 100% right.
But the great news is the movie was such a big hit for you.
Yeah.
You know? And
it's fantastic.
It was number 9 out of 10 movies. You've committed to making 10 movies. You're 60 now. And I know you're going to do The Movie Critic. We don't need to get into what it's going to be. We don't want to get into what. I don't want to know what it's going to be before I see it. But tell me about how you actually planned your career in such a way. Was it always a plan to make 10? Or as you went to 5, 6, 7, go, maybe 10 is the number.
Oh, wow. You know, it's funny because I'm sure there's interviews with me out there, like from 92 and 93 when I came out, where I'm probably preaching the opposite end of the spectrum and talking about being like Fassbender.
Right.
Where it's like, big movie, miniseries, 16mm movie that I do in 1 week.
Right. Just want to keep making movies.
Yeah, big ones, low ones, this, yeah, one, that one. Yeah, just, you know, a whole potpourri of stuff. A couple movies I finance myself. I think that was probably where I was probably thinking of way back when. But then, you know, that ended up not working out. And then a certain kind of pattern developed, partly because I'm a writer.
Right.
you know, it would be a completely different career if I was at the mercies of just looking for material.
Right.
Right. That I could take and put my stamp on and make my own, whether that material is whatever scripts that are available or a book material that I adapt. The whole career would be different. Who knows?
And
if you don't love my voice, you could actually think that that might have been a better career. And it might have been a more varied career, all right? Because right. if I was forced to take other writers' imagination, other writers...
Well, like Jackie Brown was the one time you'd use a character from a novel.
But more about the idea, about the fact that, like, everything has to, you know, since I write my own stuff, everything starts from the blank page. Everything starts from square one for me. So if I'm writing the whole damn thing, then you know, square one is going to be something that I'm drawn to or interested in. And probably not a surprise.
Right.
That I'm drawn to it. But if I was, but if I was more of a director who was, you know, like a Spielberg, who's more dependent on material, whether that be a book, or whether it be scripts that are around and everything, then yeah, I would probably be drawn to a different genre than I would ever contemplate on my own.
Right. But there's no question in seeing one of your films that it's one of your films.
Yeah,
it can be a World War II movie. It can be 1970s Hollywood. It can be Django. Mm-hmm. But there is no question about the personality of the filmmaker behind it and the creation of it. It is so much reflective of you in such a unique way.
Well, okay, when you say that, though, okay, is that... is... would you say 75% of that is the sense of humor?
Yeah, I would say it's a sense of, well, not just a sense of humor, but an energy. There's a smart-ass quality to a certain degree, but mm-hmm. there's also a sense of propulsion mm-hmm. behind everything that you make. Whether it's Jackie Brown or whether it's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood or whether it's Django Unchained, mm-hmm. there's still this personality. The dialogue is really crisp and smart and creative, but feels genuine coming out of a person's mouth.
Oh, thanks.
And but you, more than almost any other filmmaker I can think of, you look at one of your movies and you say, I know who this filmmaker is.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, it's interesting what you're saying about, like you're saying, a sense of propulsion, because, I mean, one of the things that people, I'll talk about with people about my writing process is... it took me a while to kind of figure this out. Is I would spend all this time kind of like mapping out what I think the story is going to be before I officially start writing it.
Really? You put that on paper, your notes
and
everything?
Yeah, more or less. Not like a 30-page outline or anything like that. More like a diagram.
Uh-huh.
Then I'll go to this, and then I'll go to this, and then I'll go to this, and then there'll be the scene with the old lady, and then it'll all end up to Bulldog Drummond, you know, capturing the guy with the death ray. And so I kind of work it all out, and the reality is as I'm writing the script, more or less, and it is a more or less situation, more or less, I pretty much follow that diagram that I have, that more like almost like a table of contents,
right
moments, I kind of follow that pretty good until I get to the middle of the screenplay. And see, by the time I get to the middle of the screenplay, now I know these characters in such a profound way that I could never know them before I started writing.
Right.
You have to commit.
Yeah.
To writing them to get to know them that well.
I agree.
All right. And so I kind of needed that. I kind of needed that set of instructions by the mid movie. Then mid story, I take my hands off the handlebars.
Right. You turn your back.
And I let the characters.
Yeah.
I let the characters take it. Now, that's not quite as foolhardy as maybe it might sound, because I'm dealing in genre.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. It's like the idea isn't to obliterate. My idea is always to go beyond the genre.
Right.
All right. You know, but not to obliterate it.
Right.
So, okay. So do I exactly know how Kill Bill is going to end. Well, exactly? No, I don't. But I'm pretty sure she's going to kill Bill. Now, how she does it and exactly the mood and the mood when she does it and how we'll feel about it when she does it, that is to be determined.
Right, right.
All right. But the whole point was, part of that propulsion is the fact that I am, while I'm trying to fuck around with genre as much as I can, I'm also kind of playing by the rhythms of it.
Right. And characters guide you when you're writing.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's like, we're going to find out what happens with Django and everything, but it's going to end in some sort of a big shootout. Yeah. It's fucking Django. Right? It's a fucking spaghetti Western. How else do you think it's going to end?
Exactly. Exactly. It's good. Well, what is your process as opposed to writing, the directing process? Do you plan it out? Do you storyboard? Do you shot list? Do you have the... You know, working on the budgets that you do, you have time to rehearse that a lot of people don't get into.
Yeah, I usually have a 2-week rehearsal. I don't use it that much, but at some point in pre-production, I sit down with the script and I write. I don't draw, so I don't do storyboards, but I do a shot list for every scene.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of like, it's like, now I'm thinking about it visually. And it's the first time I've been thinking about it visually. And I'll do the whole film. So this is me now, like writing it all over again, but just from a visual point of view. And, okay, so now if there's a scene where they're a normal scene, two people talking in a real estate office, all right. So in this instance, I will write out how I will shoot that.
Uh-huh.
But unless I come up with something really amazing, that's not what I'm not going to ever look at this again when it comes time to shoot the movie.
Right. You shoot it in advance in your head. And then when you're there, you know what you're
doing. Well, it's sort of me just making it a point of making it all visual. Now, where it really comes into play with anything really special I want to do. Oh, maybe I want to do this all in one shot. Right. Or maybe I want to do this in some way that, like, it's going to require some equipment.
Right.
You know, or it's like, oh, wow, that's a lot of setups for this. But I think it kind of works that way. But I might need a couple more days, all right, to get all the setups that I need done with this. So what it is it points out the scenes that I might make a bigger deal out of.
Right.
All right. So that helps me with there. But the thing is, when it comes to, but when I'm actually shooting the movie, when it comes to just a regular scene and even big deal scenes.
Yeah.
I show up on the set that morning, say it's Thursday. I show up on the set. We send the crew away and then I just rehearse with the actors and I rehearse and rehearse. And then I figure it out.
Have you rehearsed with them before?
Sometimes yes, sometimes
read
no.
Read through or?
Yeah, well, no. Well, there'll be a 2-week rehearsal, but now we're 3 months into the shoot.
Right.
All right. So we did that then, and maybe we'll do it again now. But now it's today, and how do we feel about it today?
Mm-hmm.
And so then the thing about it is, we nail the scene. We get the blocking we want. This is what we're going to do. Then I bring in the keys. And we show them the scene.
Right.
They watch the scene. Then they ask any questions we have. Then we send the actors off to makeup. Then I sit down. Now I know what I'm going to do. Then I sit down and then I write my shot list for the day.
Ah, interesting.
And then I write the shot list. I give it to the first AD. He Xeroxes it. And now that's what we're doing.
And you start to work.
Sorry, Xing them off, yeah.
Amazing. I think one of the great bold moves was shooting Hateful Eight in 70mm. You know, these big, beautiful shots of the snow and everything. And then the whole thing takes place inside a station. Yeah. But it's still 70mm, and it's beautiful.
Why? Well, you know, it's like... It cracks me up because there was so many people taking swipes at me, all right, you know, these amateur critics. They're like, well, he goes to shoot 70mm and he sticks it all in a cabin. With, you know, and it just makes me think about how conventional that kind of comment is, as if 70 millimeter is only meant to shoot horizons, or only meant to shoot mountains, mountainscapes, or only meant to shoot babbling brooks and you know, basically travel logs.
Yeah.
All right? But actually, 70 millimeter is meant for close-ups.
Right, right.
I mean, Sam Jackson's face in those close-ups in the is really amazing.
Where you see every pore.
Yeah.
It's really great. Well, what about critics? You pay attention to them. You used to cut out reviews, not of your own movies, but of other movies and the like. What is their importance to you as a filmmaker?
Well, it's the word of the day. Now, the word of the day can be wrong, all right? But it's the word of the day. No, I'm always really I'm always can't wait to read what the critics say, and so look, I'm really happy. I'm always happy with my movie.
Yeah,
you know. So if I did a movie that I was really really happy with, and then everybody really took it the wrong way, then I might feel more burned about the situation.
Yeah.
But it really normally is like there's the people who really really like what I do.
Yeah,
and then there's the people who really, really don't like what I do, and then I hear what they have to say about this one, and I hear what this group has to say about that one, and then there's a group in the middle that can go this way or that way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, depending on the movie, but you know, I'm usually shaking my fist in the air at the ones that don't like me and made it a practice of not liking me, hearing what they have to say, but I need to listen to it.
Yeah, well, you're making work for public consumption, you have to have the ride of the hide of a rhinoceros.
Yeah.
But you're going to get the slings and arrows regardless. There's going to be people who love and don't love your work.
Yeah.
Especially when you have such a strong cinematic personality as you. And I love your attitude toward criticism in your book, Cinema Speculations. You become a film critic in that book, but it's usually a cheerleading film critic.
Well, I try not to do that much. I mean, that's one of the things that actually people are, I mean, it's interesting because I didn't put a foreword in the book, which is kind of strange for a cinema book. I mean, people could spend 2 years writing the book and almost like 6 months writing the foreword, all right? It's usually like, okay, this is the mission statement of the book.
Yeah.
And so my first chapter was going to be the foreword, but then it got past that until it became a chapter onto its own. So I thought, well, but this kind of does a good job of setting up the book. Well, it does do a good job of setting up the book, but it kind of doesn't do a good job of setting up where I'm coming from on it a little bit.
I see.
All right. And so and I've read a lot of confusion since then, because it is, if a director is going to write about 12 movies or 15 movies, then kind of the way it almost is set up from the way we've had it in the past, it's probably going to be 12 or 15 movies that they really love.
Right, right.
12 or 15 movies that are a real big deal to them. That's not necessarily the case with this
book. No, no, no. There are definitely movies that you don't love that you talk about in here.
And then, you know, it's more, so this is not, let me pick 15 movies and turn you on to them.
Right,
you know,
right.
No, I'm not coming from that.
That's easy.
I'm not coming from that point of view. I'm coming from, here's are 15 movies or 12 movies, however many it is. Here's are 15 movies that I think I have something interesting to say about.
Yeah.
I think that there's an interesting conversation here. And I think I have something interesting to say. And usually what I have to say isn't that interesting unless there's some negativity involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
I want the kind of the push and the pull of I like this and I don't like that. This works, this doesn't work.
But you also say why, and not just as a filmmaker.
I do try to, yeah.
Yeah, as a film watcher as much as a filmmaker.
Yeah, yeah.
And how it affects you personally and how the circumstances under which you saw it. You know,
that ends up becoming a thing, and then I didn't know that was going to be such a thing at the beginning.
Right.
And then it began, well, no, that's almost the point of everything.
Right. Well, your mother's boyfriend, Reggie, who was black, brought you into the world of blaxploitation films in a way that another white kid might not have been able to.
To say the least, yeah.
And it's become a but it's become a big part of your voice as a filmmaker, too.
It has.
And so you'll get criticism for taking on black characters and dialogue and the like. Mm. But you came from that. That was a part of your life. Reggie introduced you to something really important in your filmmaking canon.
Yeah, no, it was like it was actually interesting in writing it because when I'm talking about me, and me is like 1972, so I guess what is that, the 9-year-old me? I guess
right.
It is. Okay, you know, I'm guessing on that right now. So there's me in the audience, and then there's the black audience that's around me.
Right.
And so I'm writing it, and so there's me, and that's separate. Then there's the black audience. That's its own thing, but then there's the audience, and that's a we.
Yeah, yeah.
I was the only white person there, but as an audience, it was a we.
Yeah, you were part of them. Yeah.
We responded to this.
Yeah.
We laughed at this. I wasn't separate from them.
Right, right.
All right. We responded to this. We cheered at this. We laughed at this.
That's a really important point.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're part of the group. Mm-hmm. You weren't the white kid alone.
No, yeah, you know, I even yelled out, "Suck my dick!" Right, the bus is coming. Yeah.
Now, there's no greater love than owning movie theaters. No greater movie love. And you now own 2 movie theaters here in Los Angeles. You just opened up the Vista Theater, which
yes.
was built in the 20s originally. Mm. This fantastic neighborhood house that had style to burn.
Yeah.
So tell me about that. That ownership, that curatorship of 2 movie theaters that only show 35mm or 16mm.
Yeah.
The purity of your love for cinema as celluloid.
Well, it all started like in the late 90s when I started my own 16mm collection. And it was me and Bob Murawski.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he had already started it. Bob Murawski and Sage Stallone.
They had their own company.
Yeah, and they started the 16, and then Bob got me into it, and there was this guy Budget Rentals. Mm-hmm. All right, that he was selling off his 16 stuff, and so that was it, and then I started buying 35mm prints from collectors, and then pretty quickly on, I realized that I was kind of a frustrated exhibitor. You'll meet actors, all right, that you're working with who are like frustrated ADs.
Right.
They know how the set should be run. They know when they should be calling people to the set and when they shouldn't be.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this guy's not doing it right. Okay, well, consequently, filmmakers can be frustrated exhibitors too. And I was able to first scratch that itch by going to Austin, and through the Austin Film Society via Rick Linklater, I was able to do these little QT film fests where I bring my prints up and show them.
Oh, nice.
And then I started doing stuff at the New Beverly, then I ended up buying the New Beverly, and then I programmed the New Beverly schedules once I took it over for like the first 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah, and then, but I was really looking forward to the idea of if I could get the Vista, because I liked the idea of having a jewel box theater.
Yeah.
You know, a beautiful single house, a total jewel box, where if you make a print, well, we have 70mm there, but if you make it, you know, if a new film makes a print, we can show it there. If there are no new movies coming out with a film print, then we'll show high-end revivals.
Right, right.
So part of the fun of the New Beverly is we show all kinds of prints. That's almost part of the fun of it.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Right.
But then, but for the most part, at least for the main engagements, maybe midnight shows will be a little different, but for the main engagements, it's like the top of the top.
Right.
You know, and it's not, and it's not on Revival House schedule per se. I mean, if we have like a 70mm festival or an IB Technicolor festival, that might be different. But for the most part, it's like revivals that can hold a week.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least 4 days.
Right.
Not the 1-day, 2-day thing.
Right. So it'd be two movies in a week.
Yeah.
Well, one of the great points of pride of my life was when my first movie, Critters 2, played at the New Bev.
Yeah.
To a sold-out crowd. It was amazing. But just want to talk briefly about your beginnings as studying acting, you know, the Torrance Community Theater and the like. But also, you played an Elvis impersonator on The Golden Girls.
Yeah, that was like that was the only official, that was the only film acting job I ever got.
But you cast yourself in Reservoir Dogs, and you're perfect in it, and you've done it in so many other things. Is it still something you really enjoy doing?
No, I'm kind of over it now.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm really...
You did it.
Yeah, I'm really over it now. I mean, insofar as, I mean... maybe now that I'm over it, if a right kind of role came along that I actually thought was a real role and I would be that would be a challenge.
Yeah,
I might be. That would be the only thing that would make me think about it again.
Yeah, I mean, you were even on Broadway in Wait Until Dark.
Yeah,
which is that.
But now it's sort of like now though it's like literally. I work my ass off on my movies, all right, you know, so if it's not my movie, it's really not worth hanging out on a set for fucking 3 weeks, all right,
or waiting for your call.
Yeah, you know, oh no, now they're fucking faxing me these fucking call sheets and this, all this paper's clogging up my house. Now I have to learn all these fucking lines, and I have to get up in the fucking morning. You know, when it's my movie, okay, those are all the drags, all right, about making a movie, all right, but when it's my movie, it's fine, all right?
And fun.
Yeah, exactly, but I don't know if it's worth it for somebody else's movie. There was a time, but I think that time has passed.
Well, Quentin, your passion for genre films and films of all kinds, and your enthusiasm is so catching. That and it's such a great opportunity to sit with you and talk with you
well,
about these
mate,
things.
Look, you're the guy that leads by enthusiasm. I mean, like I remember the first time I heard your name was way before you ever directed anything, because they talked about you as the friendly publicist at Universal, all right, in Fangoria.
Yeah.
When you were a publicist, you were a character in Fangoria. And Fangoria was, that was my movie magazine.
Yeah.
It was an American Cinematographer. It was, as you can see, there's a bunch of film comments. I read Film Comment. I read American Film. I read what was it? Movie Tone News. And Films and Filmmaking and Films in Review. I read all that. But when I was at that age, my favorite film magazine was Fangoria.
Yeah, and I love that you watched the Z Channel when first did those shows.
Absolutely,
you
know?
It was great. But I so appreciate you spending the time with us here and being our final one-on-one interview guest. And just thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on. It was a great conversation. I had a good time, mate.
Me too. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.